This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Top stories. Afghan President Ashraf Ghani says he left the country to, quote, prevent a flood of bloodshed after the Taliban entered Kabul. The UN chief urges the Taliban to exercise utmost restraint in order to protect lives in Afghanistan, as the group has vowed to provide safety for citizens and diplomatic missions. Also in the headlines, the death toll from the devastating earthquake in Haiti rises to nearly 1,300, with the number of the injured exceeding 5,700. Hello, everyone, and welcome to news. The Afghan president says he fled the country to avoid what he called a flood of bloodshed as the Taliban entered the presidential palace in the capital, Kabul. Ashraf Ghani said he believes countless patriots would have been martyred and the city of Kabul destroyed if he had stayed. The president said the Taliban have won and they are now responsible for the honor, property, and self-preservation of their countrymen. Ghani is said to have fled to a neighboring country, but a foreign ministry official has said his destination is unknown. A spokesman for the Taliban says the militants assure everyone that they will provide safety for citizens and diplomatic missions. He also says the group does not think foreign forces will repeat what he called their failed experience in Afghanistan. Reactions are pouring in after the Taliban militants took control of the capital, Kabul. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres urged the Taliban and all other parties to exercise utmost restraint in order to protect lives. European Council President Charles Michel wrote on Twitter that the security of European Union staff and citizens was the bloc's immediate priority. Meanwhile, Russia says it is working with other countries to hold an emergency UN Security Council meeting on Afghanistan. Moscow says it does not yet recognize the Taliban as Afghanistan's new lawful authority. Britain's Prime Minister Boris Johnson said countries should not recognize the Taliban as Afghan government. Well, let's bring in Mr. Max Perry. He's an independent geopolitical analyst who joins us via Skype out of New York for an exclusive reaction to these two stories that I just read. Max, it's good to have you with us on the show. How do you read the situation now?
Well, I believe that Russia is in a very difficult position here because they are, you know, on the one hand, they're going to have to negotiate with an organization that is officially banned in the country and is rightly deemed a terrorist organization. You know, there have been a lot of, I won't mention any names, but a lot of analysts who I think seem rather eager to rehabilitate or whitewash the Taliban legacy because they've, you know, rebranded themselves in recent years. But make no mistake, this is still a terrorist organization, despite, you know, whatever anyone wants to say about the fact that they're less homogenous than they used to be, or that they may be diplomatic and more practical in how they conduct themselves in terms of their politics. But, you know, just a month ago, they committed a terrorist attack where something like 70 Hazara children were killed at a school. So, you know, this is a terrorist organization, and, you know, if they want to have that designation removed by a country like Russia, you know, they're going to have to make significant concessions, especially since, you know, for Russia, this is a both a security risk. I mean, there's, amid this political crisis and this power vacuum, I imagine there's going to be a significant amount of refugees, Tajiks, pouring into Central Asia. You know, and not just Russia, but other countries. I mean, there's going to be a lot of potentially Hazaras, the Shia minority, migrating into Iran. You know, there's reports that Pakistan isn't taking in as many refugees. They already have a ton. So, you know, Russia's in a difficult position here, but, you know, they really need to step in because clearly, you know, the way that the U.S. has conducted this withdrawal has not only been completely haphazard and chaotic, but just completely irresponsible. I mean, as soon as the Taliban and the U.S. signed this peace deal in Doha, Biden made it clear that he wasn't going to approve airstrikes against the Taliban and that the Afghan National Army was going to have to defend Kabul by itself. I don't think, I mean, I myself and many other analysts were predicting that the Ghani government wouldn't last 2 months. I don't think anybody could have predicted that it wouldn't last 2 weeks. I mean, this is just unprecedented what's taken place. So there could be a very serious humanitarian crisis, and you know, Russia has and many other regional players have good reason and need to step in here, not just for their own interest, but also for the sake of the Afghan people, especially given the Taliban's nature and its history of persecuting minorities and you know, presiding over a very brutal and repressive regime. And like I said, even though they've given themselves a facelift in recent years, we don't know what could take place, especially amid a very chaotic and lawless environment where, you know, there could be retribution killings and, you know, the...
Max, let me change the question for you. A point taken, but you just mentioned about, you know, the role that larger countries like Russia can obviously play in the future dealings of the Taliban with the world countries. But don't you think, you know, it seems to me like a fact that as they have had their own secret dealings with the leaders of the different regions in Afghanistan before they entered those cities, it's impossible to me that they have not had those dealings with some international parties before even they started this large move to capture the whole of Afghanistan, or perhaps, you know, on the way to capturing the whole country, for them not to have had any sort of dealings with the foreign governments. First off, what do you think about this? And then, of course, the role that Ashraf Ghani himself played in this. You mentioned the issue of 2 weeks. I'd like to say that it's maybe even less than that. 2 weeks ago, I remember he said that I am not like such and such person to leave the country when attacked. And that was exactly 2 weeks ago. And now in 2 weeks, nobody knows where he is. On these two questions, please.
Well, even Biden was saying 2 months ago in July that, you know, there wasn't going to be any Saigon-like moment where American personnel were having to be evacuated on a helicopter, and that, as we all know, that's exactly what took place today. So no, there's no question that it's unprecedented what's taken place, and, you know, to be perfectly honest, I'm not even sure that the nature of this withdrawal is even comparable to Vietnam, because, you know, at least in the latter case, the government in Saigon lasted a full 2 years, and same thing when the Soviets pulled out in 1989, it lasted 3 years until the Taliban emerged. I mean, this is just a very, very rapid power vacuum that's occurred. You know, I'm not sure that the Russians really, and as well as the Chinese, you know, it seems to me like you were alluding that the Taliban had some sort of outside help, and I do think that this is being instigated to a certain extent by the Pakistanis, but, you know, I'm not even sure that it would be opportune for them to have an outright Taliban rule, because they have their own Taliban affiliate domestically, and a complete Taliban takeover would mean possibly emboldening the TPP within Pakistan,
right.
or Pashtun nationalism, a Pashtun insurgency. So, you know, this is a security risk for all parties involved, even the ones like that are Pakistan doesn't officially support the Taliban, but obviously elements within the military and government do. Mm-hmm. So, but I think that all parties involved here, region, it's in their interest to have a negotiated peace settlement, a power sharing agreement where there isn't right conditions for a civil war.
Yeah.
So
Max,
whether it's Russia or anybody else needs to step in and mediate the situation.
Sure. All right. Many, many thanks. That's Mixer. Max Perry. He's an independent geopolitical analyst out of New York. I really appreciate your time, Max. Have a good night. Political commentator Mohammad Dawood Miraki believes the takeover of Afghanistan by the Taliban is an indication that 20 years of U.S. policy toward the country has been an utter failure.
Well, it's the issue is this, that it should show a signal to the world that you cannot impose on countries your will. You cannot impose your system on other countries. You cannot mold the country according to your values. I had said this for many years from the beginning of the invasion until today, that the United States is bound to fail in Afghanistan. Afghanistan is not a joke when they refer to it as the graveyard of empires, because Afghans are independent people. In particular, the Pashtun people have fought entire battle, at least until, past 2 years, there were barely any commanders from other ethnic groups. The Pashtuns, who are the absolute majority, have fought against the United States and have brought the United States to the position that it was compelled to negotiate with Taliban. Before that, they used to refer to Taliban as terrorist organization or any other, adjectives in order to, for their own end, of course. But when it came to the battlefield, when it came to the perseverance of the people, they stood their ground, and the consequences, of course, what we saw with our own eyes today.
Iran has expressed readiness to continue its peacemaking efforts in its embattled eastern neighbor, Afghanistan. In a tweet, the Iranian foreign minister said violence and warlike occupation can never resolve issues. Mohammad Javad Zarif welcomed an announcement by former Afghan President Hamid Karzai for the formation of a coordination council. Zarif expressed hope that the initiative can lead to dialogue and a peaceful power transition in Afghanistan. According to Karzai, the council was formed to prevent chaos and oversee peace and transition-related affairs following the abrupt departure of President Ashraf Ghani from Afghanistan. The council is comprised of Karzai himself, chairman of the Afghan High Council for National Reconciliation, Abdullah Abdullah, and the leader of the Hizb-e-Islami party, Gulbuddin Hikmatyar. The Secretary General of the Lebanese Resistance Movement, Hezbollah, has blamed Washington for the fuel crisis in his country. Said Hassan Nasrallah said the fuel shortage is not coincidental. He accused the U.S. Embassy of causing the fuel crisis and orchestrating attacks on electricity stations. He highlighted that Hezbollah will bring gas and diesel into Lebanon from Iran. He also called on the Lebanese, who are bargaining on the U.S., to look at what has happened in Afghanistan. Nasrallah said he will issue an important statement in the next few days. Lebanon's central bank announced days ago that it would stop subsidizing fuel, a move which could cause prices to shoot up. Our correspondent Mariam Saleh says Hezbollah Secretary General believes the U.S. is operating a, quote, black room in its Beirut embassy from where it has orchestrated the fuel crisis in Lebanon.
He said that he considered that everything that is happening is the result of what's happening, not just the fact that we've reached a state of a crisis, but also the fact that we have people who are monopolizing diesel or monopolizing fuel or gas. That is also the result and the planning of a black room that is found in the U.S. Embassy, which has its own collaborators that are unfortunately members of Lebanese people who are claiming that they were with a revolution in Lebanon, there was a change in the government, and so on and so forth. But he blamed them of actually attacking fuel stations and attacking electricity power stations, and even with the only 2 or 1 hour that a shortage that is happening there, and this is resulting in actually no electricity at all in some parts. He's accusing directly the U.S. He linked this to what's happening in Afghanistan. He said that despite the fact that in Lebanon we have too many trouble or problems to really ponder on what's happening in Afghanistan, but if you look at just the fact that they were there occupied by the Americans for 20 years, the Americans were orchestrating everything that's happening in Afghanistan. They say they trained the army and so on and so forth, and now they left it back, just giving it to the hands of the Taliban. People are left thirsty, they're left hungry, they're left, even those who were with the Americans were deceived, and those who were not with the Americans are left in that state of sorrow.
An advisor to Israel's education minister has been gunned down by unknown assailants outside his home in the town of Ramah. Medical personnel said they found the body of 50-year-old Sahar Ismail when they arrived at the scene on Sunday. According to medics, Ismail had no vital signs such as pulse or respiration, and as a result, they pronounced him dead. Almost 20 shots had been fired. Ismail had been a longtime activist with the Likud party before joining the New Hope party. And our last headline story takes us to Haiti, where that country's civil protection authorities say the death toll from the Saturday major earthquake has jumped to nearly 1,300. Search and rescue operations are underway to find survivors of the 7.2 magnitude quake. So far, 5,700 people have been confirmed injured. Hospitals around the epicenter have been overwhelmed. The earthquake hit the west of the country, causing severe damage in at least two cities. The tremor was felt throughout Haiti and across the Caribbean, including in Cuba and Jamaica. Haiti's prime minister has declared a state of emergency for a month. The country is vulnerable to earthquakes and hurricanes. In 2010, if you recall, it was struck by a devastating quake that killed over 200,000 people. And that's it with international news.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight. Top federal intelligence agencies failed to adequately warn law enforcement officials before the 6th of January riot that pro-Trump extremists were threatening violence, including plans to storm the Capitol, infiltrate its tunnel system, and bring guns, according to a new report by two Senate committees that outlines large-scale failures that contributed to the deadly assault. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Luke Broadwater and Nicholas Fandos. The piece is titled Senate Report Details Security Failures in 6th of January Capitol Riot. Top federal intelligence agencies failed to adequately warn law enforcement officials before the January 6th riot that pro-Trump extremists were threatening violence, including plans to storm the Capitol, infiltrate its tunnel system, and bring guns, according to a new report by two Senate committees that outlines large-scale failures that contributed to the deadly assault. The 127-page joint report is the most comprehensive and detailed account to date on the intelligence, communications, and policing failures around the Capitol riot. An FBI memo on 5th of January warning of people traveling to Washington for war at the Capitol never made its way to top law enforcement officials. The Capitol Police failed to widely circulate information its own intelligence unit had collected as early as mid-December about the threat of violence on 6th of January, including a report that said right-wing extremist groups and supporters of President Donald J. Trump had been posting online and in far-right chat groups about gathering at the Capitol, armed with weapons, to pressure lawmakers to overturn his election loss. "If they don't show up, we enter the Capitol as the Third Continental Congress and certify the Trump electors," one post said. "Bring guns, it's now or never," said another. The first congressional report on the Capitol riot is the most comprehensive and detailed account to date of the dozens of intelligence failures, miscommunications, and security lapses that led to what the bipartisan team of senators that assembled it concluded was an unprecedented attack on American democracy and the most significant assault on the Capitol in more than 200 years. The failure to adequately assess the threat of violence on that day contributed significantly to the breach of the Capitol, said Senator Gary Peters, Democrat of Michigan and the chairman of the Homeland Security and Government Affairs Committee. Senator Gary Peters added, "The attack was, quite frankly, planned in plain sight." The 127-page joint report, a product of more than 3 months of hearings and interviews and reviews of thousands of pages of documents, presents a damning portrait of the preparations and response at multiple levels. Law enforcement officials did not take seriously threats of violence, it found, and a dysfunctional police force at the Capitol lacked the capacity to respond effectively when those threats materialized. "The failures are obvious," said Senator Amy Klobuchar, Democrat of Minnesota and the chairwoman of the Rules and Administration Committee. "To me, it was all summed up by one of the officers who was heard on the radio that day asking a tragically simple question, 'Does anybody have a plan?' Sadly, no one did." In response to the report, the Capitol Police said in a statement that its leaders agreed that the force needed improvement, including changing the way it collects and shares intelligence. But it insisted that law enforcement officials had no way of knowing that a pro-Trump rally would turn into a mass assault. Before 6th of January, the Capitol Police leadership knew Congress and the Capitol grounds were to be focus of a large demonstration, attracting various groups, including some encouraging violence, the statement said. But it added, neither the USCP nor the FBI, US Secret Service, Metropolitan Police, or other law enforcement partners knew thousands of rioters were planning to attack the US Capitol. The known intelligence simply didn't support that conclusion. Yet the Senate investigation found that the department had ample warnings weeks earlier that violent extremists, including members of Proud Boys and Oath Keepers, were planning such action and failed to share it widely or incorporate the warnings into its operational plan for 6th of January. Several comments promote confronting members of Congress and carrying firearms during the protest, a Capitol Police intelligence analyst wrote in a threat report on 21st of December, which included a map of the Capitol complex that had been posted on the pro-Trump blog TheDonald.win. Among the posts cited in the threat report, "Bring guns, it's now or never, and we can't give them a choice. Overwhelming armed numbers is our only chance." The Senate's investigative report is the product of a collaboration among Senator Gary Peters, Senator Amy Klobuchar, and the top Republicans on the two committees they lead, Senator Rob Portman of Ohio on the Homeland Security Committee, and Senator Roy Blunt of Missouri on the Rules Committee. It is limited by its bipartisan nature, given that Republicans have refused to ask questions about the riot that could turn up unflattering information about Donald Trump or members of their party, as they try to put its political implications behind them before the 2022 midterm elections. Though the report states flatly that Mr. Trump continued to assert that the election was stolen from him and promoted the Stop the Steal gathering in Washington before the riot, it does not chart his actions or motivations, state that his election claims were false, or explore the implications of a president and elected leaders in his party stoking outrage among millions of supporters. The inquiry does not describe the events of 6th of January as an insurrection, a term many Republicans had joined Democrats in embracing immediately after the attack. Aides involved in its drafting said they had refrained from trying to summarize or contextualize Donald Trump's false claims just before the riot took place. They opted instead to include the full text of his speech in an appendix. Many of the findings in the report were culled from public testimony from committee hearings, though five people sat for detailed interviews with the committee. Christopher C. Miller, who was the acting defense secretary at the time, Ryan D. McCarthy, the Army Secretary, General James C. McConville, the Army Chief of Staff, Yogananda D. Pittman, the acting chief of the Capitol Police, and J. Brett Blanton, the architect of the Capitol. The committee staff solicited more than 50 statements from Capitol police officers that painted a vivid portrayal of the rioters, some of whom gave Nazi salutes and hurled racist slurs at them. One officer described being crushed by the mob. Another told the committee that she still suffered from chemical burns she experienced that day. About 140 law enforcement officers reported injuries from the riot. The bipartisan report also tied seven fatalities to the assault, including five protesters who died and three police officers who died in its aftermath, two from suicide. The document lays out profound problems with the Special Capitol Police Unit that handles civil disturbances, only a fraction of which was adequately trained to respond to a riot and which was poorly equipped. On 6th of January, its officers were not authorized to wear protective gear at the beginning of their shifts or to use their most powerful non-lethal weapons, such as grenade launchers and sting ball grenades, to push back crowds because they lacked the training to do so. Let's be honest, Capitol Police were put in an impossible situation, Senator Rob Portman said. Without adequate intelligence, training, and equipment, they did not have the tools to protect the Capitol. The committees recommended 20 improvements, like beefing up police training and equipment and forming a single intelligence bureau in the Capitol Police to better share information. Their suggestions followed from Lieutenant General Russell Honore, a retired Army officer whom Speaker Nancy Pelosi of California chose to lead a House task force that recommended the hiring of more than 800 Capitol police officers. The construction of mobile fencing around the complex and changes to Capitol Police Board procedures to allow the agency's chief to quickly summon the National Guard in an emergency. Senator Roy Blunt of Missouri said he and Senator Amy Klobuchar would soon introduce legislation to grant the Capitol Police Chief power to unilaterally summon the National Guard in emergencies. He said they were also likely to assemble a spending bill to increase funding for the department and carry out other changes. There was much information the panel was unable to learn. The senators secured only limited cooperation from key agencies, including the FBI and the Department of Homeland Security, the Justice Department, and the House Sergeant-at-Arms. Other agencies failed to meet deadlines to hand over documents. The findings and their limitations are likely to fuel renewed calls for an independent commission, like the one created after the 11th of September 2001 attacks, populated by experts and armed with subpoena power to investigate what happened on that day and why. Senate Republicans blocked the creation of such a body late last month, arguing in part that it would duplicate the work already underway by the Senate committees and prosecutors at the Justice Department.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars from IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints you are listening to. I'm Atta, the host of this program. Please accept our condolences on the martyrdom anniversary of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and the arrival of the month of Muharram. With me in the studio for today's discussion are two guest speakers, Dr. Muhammad Reza Fakh Rouhani, a faculty member of the University of Qom. Assalamu alaikum, doctor. Welcome to the show.
Assalamu alaikum and welcome to you.
You're welcome, brother. And also, brother Ali Alavian is over here, an Islamic expert from the Islamic House of Qom. Assalamu alaikum, brother, and very welcome to this show.
Wa alaikum assalam, and thank you for having me here.
So, since this is the month of Muharram and the most tragic event during the history took place in this month, that is the martyrdom of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and his companions and family members, his faithful, loyal companions, Brother Mahmoud, the producer of this program, decided to dedicate this session and the upcoming ones to the atrocities and the corruptions that were done by the Umayyads during their rulership over Muslim lands. We know that from 41, we can say AH, till 132 AH, for 91 years, the Umayyad established a government on the Muslim lands, starting from Levant and getting all across the borders of the Muslim lands out of Arab Peninsula and Hejaz, today Saudi Arabia. But all of a sudden, many values have been changed, and many pure Islamic values have been violated. We know that the most horrendous, we can say, massacres happened during this period. We could see that what happened to the family and the companions of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. We could remember what they have done to, in the Harra event, the massacre of the people and the killing of the people over there. Also, Mukhtar al-Saqafi uprised against them, but he was killed again. And you know that in these 91 years, we can say Islam was deviated from the right path. This was what Umayyads did, Umayyads and their kings and the rulers did to the Muslim Ummah on that time. Dr. Fakhrouhani, let's start with you. Give us a historical background, how the Umayyads got power and how they established a government in the Muslim lands.
Yes.
Because they are not at all like a pure Muslim, according to what Prophet Muhammad claimed, that this one is a Muslim, this one is an Islamic ruler, or he gave the standards and the criteria. How did they establish a government in Arab Muslim lands on that time?
Yes. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim wa bi nasta'in. In this regard, I mean, regarding the background of the Umayyad dynasty, it must be indicated that, first of all, we have to go back, I mean, we have to trace the background to the pre-Islamic period in Arabia.
That's right.
Okay? As we know, the city of Mecca, because of the Kaaba over there, has been especially favored by not only Arabs, but all those people who favored monotheism.
That's right.
Okay?
That's right.
And in Arabia, there were some Arab clans and Arab tribes. Okay? The Quraysh, who was the main, I mean, who made the main, I mean, populace of the region, was divided into two main clans, Hashimites, or the sons of Hashem, and Umayyads, okay?
Or the sons of Umayyah.
Umayyah, yes.
That's right. Umayyah was the grandfather or the forefather.
Yes, the ancestor.
The ancestor, that's right.
And at that time, for some time, the Umayyads were in charge of custody of the Kaaba.
Okay.
And they pretended to favor the pilgrims who used to come from almost all parts of the Arab world of the day to Mecca on pilgrimage.
That's right.
Historical records indicate that while the Umayyads were in charge of the Kaaba and the main sanctuary of Mecca, in the guise of helping the pilgrims, they looted their properties and they did unjust to pilgrims. Okay, for some time, they showed that in order to perform pilgrimage around the Kaaba, to do the circumambulation around the Kaaba,
okay,
it was necessary to buy the Hajj garment, ihram, from the Umayyads and not from anybody else. And in case there wasn't anything, people were, were right to be naked and, to
That's
do
right.
the, rituals, in a naked mode.
And we know that the tribe of Umayyah on that time, and also Harb, the son of Umayyah, the father of Abu Sufyan, were famous for their business transactions all out of the Arab Peninsula on that time. They were famous rich tribes on that time. They did so before Islam in the Jahiliyyah period. True aristocrats, I can call them, and the monarch of the time, whose we can say the money was important for them. So it is absolutely natural that they look at religious rituals at something to get money from. I mean, to make money out of it.
They were notorious for being too mercenary.
Uh-huh.
However, and there was a council. A council was made. In Mecca, and the Meccan important people of Mecca came to the conclusion that the supremacy of the Umayyads, the descendants of Umayyah in Mecca, as custodians of the Kaaba, brought all havocs and misfortune to the Kaaba, and deterred the people from doing pilgrimage to the Kaaba.
That's all right. Okay, thank you very much.
Sorry.
Okay.
Let me contribute just one point. Okay.
Because I have to manage the time, get to Brother Ali too. Okay.
In order to compensate it, okay, in order to make the reform, people came to the point that the other main clan, Bani Hashim, the Hashimites,
that's right,
were the most appropriate people. And since at the time the Hashimites got to power, we find that the Umayyads started developing all sorts of conspiracies against the Hashimites.
That's
right.
And when I look at the genealogy and the family tree of Umayyad, he had three important sons. They were named As, Harb, and Abi Amr. And, Abu Sufyan, Muawiyah, and Yazid, who are mainly concern with them. And the atrocities that they have done toward the Council of Muslim Ummah comes from the family tree of Harb. It is also documented that there were some disputes among the Harb and Abdul Muttalib, the grandfather or the forefather of Prophet Muhammad. It's been documented in the history. Brother Ali Al-Abiyan, let's get to you. Whenever we say Bani Umayyah and Umayyads in the Islamic calendar, the first thing that is reminded in the minds of the people is the atrocities that they have done to Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam.
Yes,
but I think we have to trace back their roots, as Dr. Fakhruhani also said, to the pre-Islamic period, the type of typical behaviors that they had, and the type of typical behavior from the Jahiliya period that they remained in themselves. They converted into Islam, but I think according to a very superficial mannerism. What's your take on that, brother?
Yeah, bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. As for the pre-Islam era that actually went to look at the role of Umayyads and Umayyads, Dr. Fakhr actually elaborated on it. Let's see what happened at the time of the, if we can call it government, if, as I myself do not believe in it, to say that, for example, the government which was at the at the hand of Hashemites, meaning the Holy Prophet and Imam Ali alayhi salam. So
right.
It's not good to call it in such a sense, but just to make it closer to understanding
okay.
for the respected listeners.
You've been establishing a state.
Yeah, establishing since
okay.
the Holy Prophet was the leader
yes.
of the Islamic Ummah, actually. We believe in Ummah and the leader of the Ummah. So we saw that actually they were silent at this time, and as it was said at the time of Hashemites, they were silent. Umayyads or the ancestors of the Umayyads or Umayyads were silent, and actually they were involved in their business and this kind of, let's say, the transactions that they had at that time,
right.
involved in their own trade and business.
That's right.
But it did not mean. It does not mean that actually they do or they did agree with what was going on. They disagreed with the system that the Holy Prophet actually introduced to the world. But since they were out of the power, so they showed their disagreement through some, let's say, hypocrisies. But anyhow.
That's right. You're absolutely right. But even Abu Sufyan, when Prophet was after... we can say conquering Mecca,
mm-hmm.
Fath al-Mecca, you
yeah.
know, he was forced and in fact into convert to Islam,
as
and it was not with open arms.
That's why actually they were called as tulaqa.
Uh-huh.
I mean, they did not accept Islam, easily. They were forced to accept it, actually.
That's right.
They found no way around. But
mm-hmm.
how they again found their way inside the government
yes.
and inside the system, it was from the time of Second Caliph, when he appointed Yazid, father of Muawiyah,
That's
as
right.
the governor of Damascus.
That's right.
Or Sham of the time.
Osman, you mean?
No, Second Caliph.
But Omar did it, but I think Osman himself was from the Umayyad side,
yeah.
from the father side, okay?
Very true.
And he gave them very much power, empowered them in different lands of
Muslims. But the influence of Umayyad actually started from the side of Sham,
mm-hmm.
where
yes.
actually this election of Yazid, father of Muawiyah, was done at the time of Second Caliph, when he actually died due to... a sickness or disease, he by himself selected Muawiyah as his successor. So we see that Muawiyah actually changed the system that was introduced by the Holy Prophet to the world. Actually, he de-Islamized, if I can use this.
Sorry, before getting to the character of Muawiyah, which was really influential in changing the system, I do want to say such a powerful man at the Levant on that time, I mean the Eastern Syria, in today's world, must have find the chances and the background to empower himself with such opportunities.
Mm.
What was the main background that made Muawiyah
actually,
find such a power?
After the Holy Prophet, at the time of the first caliph, the relationship of this Umayyad family was not that bad with the caliph. They
mm-hmm.
had only a very soft criticism on the selection of Abu Bakr as the first caliph.
That's right.
Why? Because Abu Bakr was not directly connected to the sons of Ahmed, and he was from a second-hand, let's say, tribe. He was belonging to a tribe actually connected to Quraysh, and they were actually...
And Umayyads were from the Quraysh tribe, too?
True.
Okay, that's right.
So this was their soft criticism, but anyhow, they preferred to cooperate with the new government or new system that actually was taking the hand of leadership of the Islamic Ummah. And for and mostly at the time of the second caliph, when he started conquering Islam and conquering other countries and expanding the Islam territories, they were selected as the leaders of the and the commanders of the armies to conquer some countries, namely Iran and neighboring countries. So they started working with the government informally and to some extent formally and officially.
That's right.
So this was the first, actually, glimpse of their entrance towards the system.
That's right.
Through this, actually, activities, the second caliph reached to this conclusion, no, they can be good people, so we can accept them. They had good relation, beside the curtain. And he started to actually elect Yazid as the governor of Damascus, as
you
I
mean
said.
Yazid, the father of Muawiyah.
Father of Muawiyah.
They say that there was a council.
And, and okay. Since Muawiyah loved his father too much, he named his son again Yazid.
That's right.
After
and also name. After that, Yazid also called him as Muawiyah.
Yeah.
Of course, the second Muawiyah was, they say, according to some documents, very much different and regretted the behaviors of his forefathers. Mm. But they say also, Dr. Fakhwani, thank you very much, Brother
You're
Ali. A six-member council on that time, Abdurrahman ibn Auf was one of them, and he had direct role in choosing the caliph at the time of Osman. He was in, we can say, direct connections with the Umayyads. And so the Umayyads' role in selecting the caliph also is into the scene. I mean, the conspiracies and the plots, the political plots that are done behind the scene is also clear. Thank you very much, Brother Ali Alivian and Dr. Mamarza Fakhruhani. Nice tracing back of the Islamic roots, how Umayyads got the power and how we're deviated from the right path. We will talk more about the Muawiyads and Muawiyah himself in establishing a dynasty, I mean, over there as called the Bani Umayyah, and the peace treaty that he signed with Imam Hassan al-Mustafa. What were the reasons and why Muawiyah selected Yazid, his notorious son, as the next successor to the Umayyad dynasty. It was very kind of you. I really appreciate what you do for the program Viewpoints. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to us. This is Viewpoints on IRIB English Radio. You can visit our website at parstoday.com/Ian Khalaf Islam Radio. Also send us your emails and comments on our YouTube channel and Instagram page under the title Khalaf Islam Radio. We again express our condolences on the martyrdom anniversary of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and his faithful companions. Till another episode, God bless you all. Assalamu alaikum, ya Abu Abdullah.
Look here, Zahra.
Look here, Zahra.
Look here, Zahra.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
Muharram Special. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. One of the main features of Imam Hussein's uprising was insight. Insight means observing the present events, realizing their outcome, and making the best decision accordingly. The Noble Quran compares those who have insight with those lacking it and says, "Is he who was lifeless? Then we gave him life and provided him with a light by which he walks among the people. Like the one who dwells in a manifold darkness which he cannot leave. Such has been decorated for the faithless what they have been doing." The climax of insight can be seen in Imam Hussein's movement. He recognized the conditions of society and exposed his life and his family to the hardest calamities to save mankind. Mankind is always subjected to sedition and diabolic schemes of those who intend to achieve their goals at the cost of others' life and properties. On the day of Ashura, Imam Hussein staged his great uprising to revive the religion of his grandfather, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. He said, "Don't you see that truth is not practice and falsehood is not prevented?" The Imam showed to Muslims throughout history that they should sacrifice whatever they have to revive Islam and to protect it against corruption and deviation. He reminded all that when the ruling system and scholars become corrupt, so that the Noble Quran is distorted and good is demonstrated as evil and vice versa, it is obligation to return the society to the right path. Imam Hussein, peace upon him, would supplicate, "My God, make my movement on the basis of wakefulness, my way on the basis of guidance, and cause my course to abide by growth and sublimity." The Imam would call on the people to move with insight, as insight would preserve them of misguidance and deception. Late Professor Sayyid Jafar Shahidi said, "The Ashura uprising was apparently fruitless on that day, yet it had not just one fruit, but many fruits. It seems that this uprising was quenched by Yazid's calamities, but it never subsided. The Imam's message was revived once by the uprising of Suleiman Surat and once by the rule of Mukhtar, who had staged an uprising for avenging the blood of the Master of Martyrs. Later on, it inspired all those who are suffering from the injustice of rulers." In Karbala, the encampment of Imam Hussein was the place of religious and insightful people from all walks of life who understood their historical duty properly. They knew well that they wanted and in what path they were marching. They knew that if the Umayyad regime is the rule of the Islamic realm, Islam would perish forever. Had they not acted, humanity would have been destroyed forever. Among the personalities of Karbala, the valiant brother of Imam Hussein, Hazrat Abul Fazl Abbas, peace upon him, shines like a moon. He was outstanding in bravery, horsemanship, combat, worship, and cognizance of God. He was so steadfast that Imam Sadiq, peace upon him, said, I testify that you did not show weakness for a single moment and did not return from your path. Rather, your path had been based on faith and insight. Imam Hussein, peace upon him, drew a beautiful picture by his uprising. He showed mankind that whenever oppression and injustice have permeated everywhere and the light of good virtues has subsided, we should stand up and move to revive divine values even at the cost of our lives. That's why the epic of Karbala did not end with the martyrdom of Imam Hussein and his 72 loyal companions. It has rather transcended man's history and shines like a beacon for the seekers of freedom and all divine values.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.